Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we react to Jose Mourinho's anger as Roma are beaten by Sevilla, who make it a magnificent seven in the Europa League final last night. We'll look ahead to a massive game at Wembley this weekend, the first Manchester derby in an FA Cup final in history. Can Manchester United upset the form book? We'll talk about their links to buy Mason Mount from Chelsea and his teammate Mateo Kovacic's likely move to Manchester City, as well as our reaction to Serena Wiegmann's Lionesses squad for this summer's Women's World Cup. This is The Game. Hello, welcome back to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Woozencroft alongside Molly Hudson, Tom Roddy and Gregor Robertson. Big week. We're going to be looking ahead very shortly to the FA Cup final. There's some big moves on the horizon as well, managerial and player-wise. But let's begin with last night's events in Budapest very, very quickly, because Sevilla came past Roma in the Europa League final. How can you ever count against Sevilla in this competition? They extend their record to 7 wins. It came, of course, on a penalty shootout with Gonzalo Montiel scoring the winning penalty. He also scored the winning penalty for Argentina in the World Cup final, so a couple of feathers in his cap. But it's 7 wins out of 7 in Europa League finals for Sevilla. They're sitting 11th in La Liga with 1 game to go. Their manager, José Luis Mendilibar, was only managing in his 6th European fixture ever, after a long coaching career as well. I think he's just slightly younger than Mourinho. And it was just one of those days, wasn't it, where you thought everything was going to go in their favour. I probably think they were the better side as well. And it wasn't really a great spectacle either, was it, Gregor?
No. I mean, they're reading a lot of pieces in the build-up to this about Jose. There's still a place for him in the game. Jose's football. All this kind of, yeah. But then you kind of watch the game itself and the reality of the experience of watching this kind of Jose Mourinho performance is not, it's not what dreams are made of, is it? I think it was 146 minutes of action. Just bitty, kind of spiteful football almost.
Yeah.
And I was reading a really interesting thing that this season 13 red cards have been shown to members of the Roma bench, whether the coaches or substitutes. And I think that says a lot about, you know, we saw that, all the kind of antics on the touchline and just doing anything that they can to break up the game and to win. When it went to penalty kicks, it might have worked, but it ultimately didn't, and I'm not sure there'll be that much sympathy for Roma or Jose Mourinho.
Tough job for Anthony Taylor, English ref, out in the middle. Afterwards, in the car park, we saw images of Jose Mourinho saying that he was an effing disgrace. We saw Jose throw his loser's medal up to a kid in the crowd as well. Doesn't want silvers. You know, he's still all about winning trophies, Jose Mourinho. But, you know, his future's kind of in doubt at Roma, which is quite interesting. He says, I want to stay at the club, but my players deserve more. I deserve more. I don't want to fight anymore for that. I'm tired of being a coach, a communicator, and the club's spokesperson. So clearly, there are issues for Mourinho at Roma. But ultimately, I still think he sees himself as kind of an elite level, top level coach. He should be coaching teams that are trying to win the Champions League rather than Europa League. And that's why he's maybe always got one eye kind of looking to the left.
Without a doubt. Yeah, he definitely sees himself as an elite coach. And also, I think, and perhaps this could be fair when you look at Roma's history and the fact they've reached 2 European finals in the last 2 seasons, and they hadn't done that in years and years before Mourinho came in. But at the same time, the way he sort of decides to start Dybala up front, and the way he talks after the game and the way he approaches the games suggests this feeling of David versus Goliath, and I'm the one who can, I am the slingshot, essentially. Mm. I was thinking afterwards, because the way he's speaking suggests he's leaving, and they have had a success with him there. They've had a successful period, but when Mourinho goes through clubs and leaves, it's exhausting, and clubs have to pick up the pieces afterwards. So it's never a progression and then you develop from there. It's always taking a shot, experiencing the difficulties, shall we say, that come with that, and then hoping that it works out, because you almost have to restart when he leaves.
Yeah.
We've spoken loads on this on the podcast about various clubs and a lot about Brighton, and you just think about the way that when Graham Potter left Brighton, Roberto De Zerbi comes in, everything. It's progression.
Mm.
Progression all the time, whereas I don't think Roma will be able to do that now.
He's a kind of character that's pretty abrasive, and yet I still watch what he's able to do as a cup manager and think it's going to be a big international job available next summer. Most likely, will Jose Mourinho want to take that? We know he loves this country, doesn't he? I'm just saying.
I thought you were talking about Brazil.
No, I mean, possibly, but Jose Mourinho, I think, is a cup manager, but he's a very good cup manager. Because if you look at it, their league position, for example, they're sixth, but they're only sixth because Juventus have been deducted 10 points.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they'd be seventh in Serie A. So, you know, for me, he's not a league manager anymore. He's not going to win you league titles, but six or seven games, David versus Goliath mentality, could be worse.
I would be astonished if you started with and we didn't really give enough focus to this. I mean, that the footage of what happened in the car park of the stadium where he's addressing Anthony Taylor is absolutely horrendous behaviour. Especially, I mean, you're probably talking well over an hour after the final whistle. The FA would not stand
for
that.
I can't believe
that.
We're talking about
yes,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
Players being highly mischievous here.
Yeah, right? I am. I am, in a way. I think we've got an obsession with Jose Mourinho in this country. And that's why I think his name would be mentioned. And I think ultimately people still see him as a winner. International football is not club football. It's not Champions League football. You don't have to put out a beautiful footballing side. You need to put out a winning side. And Jose Mourinho has done plenty of that. But yes, I am jesting.
I think that will happen.
Just a little bit.
I think that will happen. Not with England, but I think that
he will be
international
coach.
Football will be his next thing, because he's restless. I completely agree. He feels like he's still an elite manager. And if you're doing, that's like another avenue of elite football. If you're competing for World Cups and European Championships, yeah, and whatnot, that's his next step, I think, because there's only so long he can find the kind of drive and the, is it, like the pessimism to compete in the second and third level of European football, and when what he's always been is someone competing for Champions League.
Last word, Molly Hudson, on Sevilla Roma. Whatever you notice, whatever you want to talk about, including Jose.
To be honest, Hugh, I thought the game might never end. I saw someone on Twitter saying, like, this is the most typical game that started in May and ended in June, and it just went on and on and on. I have to say, I am a bit of a Mourinho fan, and maybe that's because I sort of grew up in his, like, golden era when he was absolutely peak Mourinho. But I sort of tuned into this game to watch him almost as much as I did have a real care about where this Europa League trophy actually went. And I think he is box office, and, you know, he still is, but I think it was almost like, this is quite enjoyable watching one game of this in a one-off sort of scenario. I was slightly grateful that I don't have to watch the Serie A and Roma every week, because I think the novelty might wear off quite quickly if you had to watch that every week.
Indeed. And look, you guys will have your opinions on whether you wanted to see, you know, Mendilibar lift the first European trophy after a long career at maybe the smaller clubs in Spain versus, if you like, the true Goliath in terms of the managerial matchup, Jose Mourinho. So maybe it was nice to see him with a medal around his neck, even though it means another Europa League trophy to put in the museum for Sevilla. Unbelievable. 7 out of 7 in finals. Incredible. Up next, let's talk about one of Jose Mourinho's former teams, because Saturday sees the first Manchester derby in an FA Cup final. The Premier League winners and Champions League finalists Manchester City need their victory to stay on course for the treble, of course, but Manchester United are looking to complete a domestic cup double after they won the Carabao Cup at Wembley earlier on in the season. United finished 14 points and 36 goals behind City. I like that number, 36 goals for City, in the Premier League. So it's a big task for United, but we all know what it means. Paul Hurst, of course, our Manchester correspondent, joins us on the Game podcast. Huge one for the fans of both clubs. But what's the significance, do you feel, of this fixture in terms of maybe United's ability to send a message that they do have what it takes to challenge and compete with City throughout the course of next season? How important a day is it for them in particular?
Well, yeah, I agree, Hugh. It's a huge day for United for two reasons. Like you said, it would demonstrate that they can go toe-to-toe with City in big matches, and they beat them early on in the season, so I suppose that'll help them in that respect at Old Trafford, even if it was a little bit of a dodgy goal that allowed them to win. But the biggest prize here is the fact that they can deny City the treble. And, you know, United, ever since City were taken over, United have always had two things over City, regardless of how much success City have had. They've always been able to say, you know, where's your Champions League and where's your treble? You know, we did that in 99, and City could do that this season. They could match it. So if United were to stop that happening, you know, that would be something that the United fans wouldn't forget for, you know, forever, basically. They would rub City fans' noses in it for many years to come. So I think that'll be in the back of the mind of the fans and the manager and the players as well.
What do you think, Gregor, in terms of Manchester United's sending a message out? I mean, how important is it? Because I think the stuff for the club is very personal, you know, and I get it. For the fans of Manchester United and for the players, you know, stopping City from winning the treble, as Hurstie points out, probably the number one thing on the list. But there is going to be a wider context for what happens after this game, if you are beaten by City. Or is that already entrenched? City are the club in Manchester now. I don't know, because I don't feel that yet. I certainly feel under Erik ten Hag, Manchester United are re-emerging. But what you don't want is the arm to come out as the little, almost like now the little brother being held at arm's length as they swing furiously their arms at thin air. You know, you don't want that. You want almost to say, yeah, I'm coming for you. So I think it is important in a wider context that United send that message.
Yeah, I think Erik ten Hag said that in Henry Winter's interview. You know, that's a big thing, stopping the treble, but we're building our own project as well. And to win two trophies in one season and finishing the Champions League, it'd be like, it's already been a big step forward, but that would be kind of underline that I think, you know, United are the real deal under Ten Hag. But I also don't think you can read too much into this one game, because there's going to be a big changes in the summer, and he said that again in the interview, that we need to spend quite a lot of money to come up to their level, which is the truth of the matter. They're not of the same level as Manchester City. So yes, they're on the way back. Yes, this would be a big statement, but I think the summer and the changes that will be seen, and a belief that United can challenge City for the league next season, is the kind of, you know, the more important thing long term.
Do you think, Kirsty, that Manchester United can stop City this weekend? I know you mentioned the victory that they had throughout the season. I think Wembley is a very different place. I think Manchester City are in a different mode right now as well. You know, when you've got the carrot of two games to get through and a treble, which would be absolutely historic for your club, but maybe even surpass what Manchester United have done. This game does take on a different complexion. Footballing-wise, do you think Manchester United will have a plan here? We know that Anthony Martial is going to be out. We know that Anthony is a doubt. And so maybe do we see almost a tactical switch from Ten Hag, maybe a plan up his sleeve to negate what City do well?
Well, yeah, he's going to have to change his formation, his team, isn't he? Because you'd imagine that either Anthony or Anthony Martial would have been in that team. But he might have to start Garnacho now, which I'd love to see. I think he's a fantastic player. I think he's shown his worth off the bench, and that's obviously against, you know, more tired legs. But he's still a very unpredictable, very fearless player. So I think if you've got him running at a, you know, maybe, I don't know, Kyle Walker, whoever's going to play at right back, it's not going to be easy because Walker is a, you know, he's a master at that, isn't he? But, you know, it's just that little bit of unpredictability that Garnacho brings that could make the difference. I think they are, United are in a better place to actually put up a fight in these kind of games now, just because of the experience of the key, some of the key players in there. You know, Casemiro's never lost a domestic final in his career. You know, I know that the Copa del Rey is obviously not as competitive as the FA Cup would be, but that kind of mentality means a lot. I think it's the same with Rafa Varane as well. He brings that to the team, so they'll be glad that he's back. But they won't have much of the ball, will they, United? You know, they'll just have to accept that. And I think they have accepted that in certain matches this season and come out on top as well. So it'll just be about being patient and getting ready to take it on the counter, because, you know, in terms of a possession-based game, they'd stand no chance against City. And I think they might have to, you know, sometimes they might have to play it long as well, straight out from the back, just like they did against Brighton in the semi-final, because sometimes when they're playing it out, it's just, you know, it's like a hot potato, isn't it? No one wants the ball. And with De Gea as well, he's not too great with the ball at his feet. So they might have to go a bit more direct this time. So they're underdogs for that reason, aren't they? That they're just not. City have got everything in their locker, haven't they? They can play. You can play possession based. You can go more direct. Use the pace. Switch the team about. Playing in different positions. So yeah, you know, United are in a better position than they have been in previous years. But you know, the City are a favourites for a reason.
The transformation of Rashford this season's been one, and it's easy to kind of forget the difficulties that Erik ten Hag's faced this year, and as Gregor said, the progression that they've had. It's so long ago now. The Ronaldo Piers Morgan interview was this season. He's had to handle the Mason Greenwood situation as well. Transforming Marcus Rashford from 5 goals last season, and I know he had his injury difficulties, but to 30 goals this year, and statistics would suggest you stop Rashford, you stop United. Is that fair, Hirsty? And how do you think, does Pep approach it in that way, or does he think, no, we play our own game?
I think definitely he does. He does, you know, concentrate on his own team a lot more than the opposition. But I agree with you. You know, Rashford is the main threat, and that's one of the feathers in Ten Hag's cap this season, that he's turned him into an elite striker, an elite forward, certainly compared to where he was last season. But yeah, Bruno Fernandes had a decent season as well. But I do agree that Rashford is the main threat. And, you know, it's funny, isn't it? You mentioned the Ronaldo interview there. You know, that seems like a few seasons ago, doesn't it? It seems ages ago. And, you know, I think removing Ronaldo from that team has just kind of unleashed, you know, it's just helped a lot of players in that side. Mm. And Rashford's certainly one of them. Mm. You know, I always thought when Ronaldo was playing for him that he was just kind of pass the ball to him. You know, he always wanted it. And, you know, because of his legend, you know, his status, even if he was in a position where he wasn't going to score, or it was nigh on impossible that he was going to score, a player felt he had to pass to him, you know, just because of the legend that he was and the status that he had. So I just think it's helped a lot of players find a lot more space and a lot more kind of freedom. Bruno Fernandes is another one. You know, start of the season, you saw Ronaldo dropping into that pocket where Fernandes was playing, and they had no one in front of him. And Bruno was almost like saying, you know, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be in the box. You know, you're the guy that finishes it. I'm the guy that sets it up. But because Ronaldo was getting so frustrated, he was just like dropping in and, you know, having, you know, just wasn't scoring goals. So, but yeah, and Rashford has been one of the beneficiaries as well. So yeah, I think if they are going to win the match, it'll probably come from him, yeah.
And as well, Hirsty, we started this by talking about the treble, and everyone, we will focus on that. Everyone will focus on that, understandably. But in terms of motivation, on both sides of the pitch, the United players aren't really going to be motivated by stopping. They're not, majority of them aren't these legacy fans who care so much about that. Their focus is going to be more on the FA Cup, isn't it? And on the City side, is the motivation the treble, or will it be more the Champions League?
Well, I think if you look at someone like Rashford, for example, he will be motivated by rubbing City's nose in it, by stopping them. So I think for some players it will be that motivation. But it's interesting, we were speaking to Rafa Varane this week for an interview that's going in the paper tomorrow, and he was saying we just need to focus on ourselves. And there is an element of that as well, that, you know, don't get kind of like dragged into the emotional side of it too much, because that could end up kind of distracting you from your game plan. You are the team, the United team, are good enough to win this match if they, you know, if they execute the game plan to perfection, which they'll have to. So yeah, there is an element of just don't get kind of swept up in the emotion of it too much, and because, you know, and an FA Cup victory, like Greg said, two cups in 1 year and finishing third would be a big success for United, considering how poorly they were last year. You know, how poorly they finished last year. 0 goal difference last year, 58 points. And that was shocking, really, for United. And 75 points this season. So it's a big improvement. But, you know, the FA Cup would be the icing on the cake for them.
Finally, Hirsty, I just wanted to reflect on what Erik ten Hag had to say to Henry Winter in the Times. And how big this game is for him personally in terms of the money. Because he says, I need players. He obviously wants Manchester United to improve next year, but very clear signals sent out to whoever the owners of the club might be in terms of when this transfer window starts. You know, Manchester United need to get cracking. We'll talk about their links with Mason Mount a little bit later on. But does he almost need to win the FA Cup for, if it is to be the Glazers on their way out, to spend some money, or maybe whoever's coming in to kind of make it a little bit more urgent in terms of getting this takeover done?
That squad does need huge work doing to it still, doesn't it? And then you're right, in the interview that Ten Hag did with Henry Winter, he was saying that we did spend a lot last season, but, you know, it was needed, and it's needed again this summer, because they need a striker. You know, Anthony Martial's out again, as you were saying. You know, how many, he's missed a whole lot of games this season. I was looking at his injury list, and it's hip injury, back injury, hamstring, illness, and a couple of other things. That's a lot for one season, isn't it? So you can't build, you know, and every player is different, and, you know, it's no slight on him, but you can't, as a player, but you can't rely on him, can you, as Martial, as a player? So you imagine that he'd have to go. So they'd have to sign not just an elite striker, you know, like Harry Kane or Osimhen from Napoli, but they'd have to sign a youngster as well, or someone to kind of as a backup, because you can't rely on Martial. And then you need a midfielder. You need someone to compete with Christian Eriksen, because Eriksen's probably played a lot more matches than you would have thought, than he thought he would have done this season, even though he's been injured for quite a lot of it. So you need another midfield there. You need a backup keeper, I imagine, someone to put pressure on De Gea, because he's been up and down this season, shot stopping fantastic, but playing it out from the back, he's not the greatest, as we know. And then if Harry Maguire goes, they'll need another centre half. So you tot all that up, and it comes to, you know, we're talking over 200 million, aren't we, here? So, you know, whoever's in charge, whether takeover goes through, whether, you know, whoever takes over, is, you know, they will have to spend a lot of money to get that team even like one step closer to where City are and Arsenal are in terms of quality. And they've got to sell well as well. United have been terrible at selling players over the last few years, and they've acknowledged that themselves. They've hung on to players for too long. You know, Phil Jones, a good example, signed a 4-year contract the week after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took over as interim manager, and he's barely played since. You know, so that's, and he'd had a lot of injury troubles before. You know, great player when he's fit, but he's not been fit for ages. So you've got to be ruthless, haven't you? You've got to say, thanks, Phil. You know, you've got to go. And then a lot of the youngsters as well have gone for tiny fees when they could have probably got 10 million from the year before. You know, Anthony Elanga's not done much this season. They probably would have got 10, 15 million for him last summer. That would have gone a long way to boosting this kitty. So if you look at, you know, McTominay, Maguire, Henderson, Elanga, Van der Beek, Tellez, Bailly, all those players, if you sell well, you could get another 100 million from that group of players. If you can find a buyer for him who was willing to pay the wages, that's another issue, isn't it? But so that will prove key, whether they can supplement that kitty that they've already got with another 100 million in sales, because that brings you another couple of top players. So it will be a very busy summer for United.
Okay, Paul Hurst, thank you for joining us on the Game Podcast, looking ahead to the FA Cup final.
Thanks.
So how do we think the FA Cup final is going to go there? Molly, I'll start with you. How do you see it panning out?
It sort of reminds me of what we were just saying earlier on about Mourinho. You wonder if maybe there's a part of Manchester United, of course, that will not want to be that team that's kind of negative and sitting back or whatever, but it feels like maybe that might be a way at least to try and stop Manchester City. I think, for me, I think that just the way City have kind of approached this second half of the season, really, that they just look very, very hard to stop. And I think it's hard to see, especially as Hirsty just listed all of the problems in the squad there and, you know, the amount of people that probably need to be moved on and people that need to come in the summer. I think when you just look at the two projects at the clubs right now, it's very hard to see Manchester City not winning that game.
Guys, help me out here. Someone give me a little bit of joy going into this game. Do we believe that Manchester United can spring a surprise?
Well, look, the performance against Brighton and Semi should give them some, I don't know, some hope, because they're playing against a team who have just as much dominance of the ball. Yeah, they've not got the same quality, but they, you know, they had to play a kind of a fairly conservative game, and they had to get the noses in front and hold on to it. You know, set pieces, and all this is not the only way they're going to look to play, but they score from set pieces. They've got to play with a real threat on the counter-attack, and they've got to win the midfield battle, and that's not going to be easy. That's we spoke about this beforehand. It's Casemiro's been brilliant, but who's going to play alongside him? And that's been an issue sometimes against Manchester City as well in the past. It's, you know, you look at if we play Wan-Bissaka and Shaw, I think that they can, on their day, they can handle City out wide. It's about the gaps in between them and the centre halves and the people who play in front of them. That's where City are going to be the biggest threat for United. So how they get that balance right between the central defenders and it's going to be two players in front of them, how they get that balance right is going to be key.
I think Fred might play alongside Casemiro.
I think the only thing is if City are distracted, I'm afraid. The fact that this is United's big day, this is United's focus, and it has been ever since they got to this final. Whereas City, like I was saying before, I would imagine a lot of these players, like Jack Grealish has spoken quite a lot, Haaland has spoken about it. It's more about the Champions League than the treble for those players and the manager. So I think they'll have an eye on next week. And also, you can't forget that in the 20 games before they won the Premier League, there was only two that they didn't win, and that was away to Bayern and Real Madrid. So they are the absolute juggernaut that we are describing them, and everyone knows they are right now. But they've also been celebrating that Premier League title, and they're now going to be focusing on the Inter and the Champions League final. From a tactical perspective as well, it'll be interesting to see how Varane... I think Varane has the biggest job of the day, dealing with Haaland. And Varane and Rashford will be the key players for United.
Rodri, Gundogan and De Bruyne might have something to say about that. I think, you know, you did talk about winning the midfield battle, and I think, you know, even if you throw Fred's energy in there, you know, the quality and the emphasis then on Casemiro and Eriksen, if Eriksen's pushed a little bit further on, sometimes he's not overly involved in the game, particularly if you know the opposition have the ball a lot. It's almost a waste of a position. So do you play with Garnacho? I don't think Weghorst will start because of the speed that you'd probably need on the counter-attack. But if Rashford plays through the middle, do you put Bruno Fernandes on the right and Garnacho or Sancho? Or you can mix it up some way. Maybe Garnacho and Sancho as your wingers, Rashford through the middle, Eriksen as the number 10. That gives you maybe more of a threat on the counter-attack. But I think it'll be tricky. That's an understatement, really. But I do think against Manchester City over the past few seasons, they have been able, Manchester United, if you like, to bring the game to their level somehow. And I think mainly that is kind of the path of most resistance. Manchester United have just gone in with it with a little bit more determination and managed to sway results in their favour against Manchester City. Because the quality, obviously, there is a gap there. And, I hate to say this game needs to be won in the trenches, but maybe a player like Fred does win a game like this for you. You know, just bringing that added tenacity. I mean, I'm literally clinging at straws here, clutching at straws here. But I think there's still a chance for Manchester United. I do think it will be closer than some people think.
Yeah, and the problem is if it isn't as close and you end up with a Man City Watford score from a few years ago, then
you can't even think about that, can you?
You mean you don't want to? But no, all I'm saying is that's the worst case scenario, yeah. And the reaction afterwards is kind of catastrophic, isn't it? But regardless of any of that, I think you would reflect on this year as real progress for Man United. And I was thinking about it earlier that in the past few weeks we've been dissecting Arsenal's end to the campaign, and the truth is that teams sit down at this stage of the year, reflect on their season, and I think Arsenal would probably think we weren't quite ready to win the Premier League, we weren't quite ready to go toe-to-toe with Man City. In truth, that's a huge jump. Man United would see this year as a huge transition period. As I referenced earlier, the fact that Ronaldo saga happened this year, they've had to handle the Mason Greenwood issue, and during this whole period they have had to transition to Erik ten Hag's style as well. And after a awfully turbulent few years. So I think they would see this as huge progress, and the building on it, that's why Erik ten Hag's been so keen to talk about transfers. And that interview that he did in the Times on Monday, I would implore anyone to read it, because it's fascinating, especially I think one of the key things that he talks about, which I found fascinating, was actually his backstory and his father owning an estate agent and almost him learning to be a manager, the basics of being a manager from his father and the employees, the 100 employees that he had in his businesses, and the unity, that the more you have that unity, the more you will go together. And you only need to look back to the beginning of the season and when they lost to Brentford in horrendous fashion, and the famous eight and a half miles the next day that they did, and the fact Ten Hag did it with them, it was a punishment, but it wasn't a slap around the back of the head and don't do it again. He was showing he was with them the whole time.
Yeah, I quite liked that from the interview. He was saying that I hate managers who are front and centre when they win, and then when they lose, it's pointing the finger at the players. And he did keep kind of returning to unity. And you've seen United change in terms of we've spoken about this all season, the culture and the sort of, you know, the togetherness and the work rate and all those things that are like making them a far more successful team. But they have still had those chinks, those kind of off days. And, you know, I instantly recoiled when Tom said if it's a, you know, Watfordish score, and it's not going to be a Watfordish score, but they've happened against City twice, 4-1 and 6-3, and it's not beyond the realms like that. City, they're often those big pressure games, in fact, when they've not really quite kind of lived up to what they're capable of. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's important that Man United make a kind of stay in the game as well for as long as possible. And the thing that they've done in the past in these games, and they did against Brighton, is if they're successful, is stay in the game, get their noses in front, just win, you know, certain moments that just change the trajectory of the game, the goals that change the game, and then City have got something else that they need to try and do, you know.
Yeah, the reference to Watford was more of a worst case scenario, and the reflection on the season as a whole could still be positive, but at the same time, United have it in them to have that off day, and City have it in them to have that kind of performance as well.
Score predictions. Let's do it. Molly Hudson.
2-0 to City. Haaland. Both goals.
Yeah, you didn't even have to say both goals. 2-0 to City. Haaland. That's all that matters. Yeah, okay. Gregor.
3-1 City.
Come on, Tom, help me out.
Well, I've got to go 6-0 City now, really, don't I? To be honest. I'm going to go 2-1 United.
Beautiful. I'm going to go 3-2 Manchester United.
Okay.
Extra time. Before we move on, I do want to talk about a few transfers very, very quickly. And we're going to start with one concerning Manchester United. That's Mason Mount from Chelsea. And pretty much this is really a Chelsea conversation, because Manchester United reportedly have reached an agreement on personal terms with Mason Mount. They still need to agree a fee with Chelsea over a move for the England midfielder. But then Chelsea starting their clear out by giving permission to Manchester City to open talks with midfielder Mateo Kovacic, which a year left on his deal, Kovacic, I get why they're allowing that. But my word, Chelsea selling two players immediately to, if you like, rivals in the league. I know they're not going for the title or anything like that, but a top four place they are. They're giving their players to other big teams in the league. So what do you make of Chelsea doing that? And also, what do you make of Kovacic possibly going to City, Mount possibly going to United? Molly, I'll start with you.
I think, and I'm sure Tom will confirm this, having sort of dealing with this day in and day out, but the whole club at Chelsea at the moment is just a mess, isn't it, really? And I think it's kind of sad, because kind of growing up, you always saw that, like, heart of Chelsea was, despite all of their spending and the whole Abramovich era, they always had kind of those homegrown players coming through, kind of being part of the team. And to kind of see the way that Mason Mount has fallen out of favour, obviously he's had his injury problems as well, but it just feels sort of very anti-Chelsea. And particularly the Kovacic one, I sort of understand it in a sense of, as you say, he's coming to the end of his contract, probably not going to start for Manchester City, but it just feels a little bit counterintuitive to strengthen your rivals in any kind of way, you know, even if it's somebody that isn't going to go on and, you know, rip up trees for them, it's still a bit odd. So I think it's just going to be a very, very big, big summer for Chelsea, isn't it? And I guess how they kind of get through the sheer amount of players that they have at the club and find out who to keep and who not to keep is certainly going to be interesting.
First of all, I think I'd pick you up, Hugh, on the expectations for next season. I think, maybe not expectations, but targets. I think they will see themselves as a Premier League title contender, and they will expect themselves to be up there because
I don't,
of
I don't
for
what
two
they see
reasons.
Themselves as. I mean, let's add a dose of reality into this.
But you've just,
they're winning the title next year. They're not getting close to winning the title next year.
Yeah, but you've just said it in the context of strengthening rivals.
No, but this is my point.
Yeah, so why would you strengthen rivals if you're going to be a Premier League title contender?
No, this is my point. On City, I don't think they're necessarily rivals at this point in time, although clearly they're a team at your end of the table. Manchester United, much more so.
Well, on Mount, I think it's been... Remember this contract that he's got at the moment that expires next summer? He signed before he'd played a single game for Chelsea's senior side. He signed it that summer after the derby.
That's incredible.
It is. Mm. And part of it is...
And farcical.
Yes.
And he wasn't given an extension.
Incredible. Yeah. That's a massive, massive oversight.
Yes. And part of that, which I think is a naivety, comes from the previous management in thinking this guy joined us at 6 years old, absolutely loves Chelsea, is steeped in it, and... The belief was that he'll finish his career here. So this will be the easiest contract we ever do. And during that period, he was Player of the Year 2 years running. He was adored by Thomas Tuchel. Before that, he was adored by Frank Lampard. And Gareth Southgate obviously picks him all of the time. And actually, there was when he was, I know Maurizio Sarri wasn't the most rated Chelsea manager during his time here, but when he was Chelsea manager and he saw what Mount was doing at Derby, he wanted him back at Chelsea, but they couldn't make that happen. So you've got this long list of managers who really, really liked him. And of course, we know now Mauricio Pochettino would like him to stay. Graham Potter really liked him. But there's been a fall down in that relationship. There's been an absolute collapse. And this is really, sadly, the end of the road in his relationship with the club. And I think it will be a great piece of business for whoever gets him. I think Man United, Liverpool, Arsenal and Bayern Munich are the serious contenders for him. And it wouldn't surprise me if he'd agreed personal terms with all of them, because that's how these things happen. Mm. The big issue is going to be agreeing terms with Chelsea. And the truth is that Chelsea need to do it for financial fair play reasons, and not just that, because they want to reinvest money for Pochettino's squad. So they need to do this, and they need to do it early.
We've said this all year since they took this approach in the transfer market, that academy players are going to hold the most value for them. So Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I'm sure, will leave. Just seen that Levi Colwill, there's been a 30 million bid from Brighton, which they turned down, but I bet you if they gave him the right money, they would accept that. So
I don't think so.
They've got to keep Colwill.
Yeah. I think
at least one season, give him an opportunity. He looks great.
If it's the right money, it's pure, because it's the same thing. It's the same reason. It's pure profit. It's pure profit. So we said this like before January as well. This could see sort of a tearing out of that. Molly said growing up, remember Chelsea being, you know, having academy players. Maybe showing your age there a little bit, Molly, because it's a fairly new phenomenon. But it has been for the last 4 or 5 years at least. Like, this has been a thing that Chelsea fans have been able to hold on to through all the tumult. And there's a good chance that part of it's going to be kind of ripped out. And I just cannot believe that Mason Mount, it's very hard to believe he would want to leave Chelsea as well, unless the club had changed in such a remarkable fashion over the past 12 months. So it's an absolutely disastrous move for Chelsea.
I personally would love it if Mason Mount went to Manchester United. I think there are far too many people who are disparaging about his talents. I think for his age, what he's done already in football shows you that he must be, you know, quite some player. I think, he kind of got a bad rap for constantly being picked by his managers. I guess the viewers at home couldn't necessarily see it, but I think all the managers, all the coaches, the ones that have been winning trophies, have, including the England manager Gareth Southgate, for quite some time. So I don't really see how Mason Mount can be that bad a player, although he clearly hasn't had the best season of his career. I think it's almost a good time for someone to be buying him, because firstly, he's going to have hunger, want to prove himself, want to get back out there winning trophies. But also, because of the last season, the price is probably not as high as it could have been. You're probably saving yourself 20 million quid. I mean, I know there are some reports that Chelsea want as much as 80 million. I think other places say 60 million. And I think 60 million would be quite a bargain, to be fair.
I think, 1 year left on the contract, I think it would be. But that's the reason, Hugh, why I was listing off the managers, including Sarri, to basically say that every single person who has worked with Mason Mount has wanted to work with Mason Mount and to keep him. And one of the first things Thomas Tuchel looked to do when he got to Bayern Munich was to get him over there, because he saw the potential situation. And he has had not the best of seasons this year, but I can't think of any Chelsea player who has had a good season. That has been a theme of this turbulent year, so it's not been the best environment to work within. And at the same time, you reflect, and also I would expect that this situation off the field that has got us to this point would also impact that as well. And before that, he was player of the year the previous two seasons. He scored 11 goals and provided 10 assists in the season before this one. And he has also proved to be a model professional. And actually, I think he would really, really suit the culture that Erik ten Hag is trying to instill at Manchester United. One of his big mates as well. I know this isn't necessarily a huge factor in decisions of where players go, but one of his big mates is Luke Shaw from England camp. He gets on really, really well with Luke Shaw, so I think it would be a smart piece of business for Man United to do.
Just one other, I guess, transfer-related piece of news. Thomas Tuchel, not just interested in Mason Mount, apparently. Declan Rice as well, West Ham United midfielder. Just quickly to touch on this, reports are that they've had a conversation over a prospective move. I know West Ham United, of course, have the Europa Conference League final to focus on at this point in time. I'm quite excited by the prospect of an England midfielder of the level of Declan Rice playing for a club as big as Bayern Munich. I think reports also suggest that Arsenal are still the front runners for his signature, but it would be a very difficult team to turn down.
It would be, yeah, it would be. And the thing is, it depends partially what motivates you, because you can go to Bayern Munich. My understanding is that the offer actually from Bayern Munich is more lucrative than the Arsenal one, so you can have a little bit more money in your back pocket. You can probably, almost certainly actually, end your career with more honours because of the way Bayern dominate the Bundesliga and are very, very often one of the final four in the Champions League. So the potential for a legacy and honours is possibly greater at Bayern than Arsenal. But it's also easy to forget the human side when transfers come along. And Declan Rice has a very young family, and he can, if he plays for Arsenal, he can stay in the situation he's in. He can stay in the Premier League, which is he's grown up watching, and being in the Premier League as part of a team that Mikel Arteta is trying to now evolve to maintain that title challenge and to get to FA Cup finals. And of course, you go to Arsenal, you are playing in the Champions League as well. So I suspect it stays the same. I suspect he sticks with Arsenal, but it's a nice spanner to have been put in the works by Tommy T.
Absolutely. Okay, Tom Rulley, Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for being with me. Molly and I are going to continue our conversation as we look at Serena Wiegmann's Lionesses World Cup squad.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As Molly and I take a look at Serena Wiegmann's Lionesses World Cup squad, interesting headlines from it, Molly. The Euro 2022 top scorer, Beth Mead, not included. She hasn't fully recovered from her anterior cruciate ligament injury, which we did expect. But the Spurs striker, Beth England, hasn't been involved since last summer, is included, scoring 12 goals in her past 12 WSL games. The Chelsea centre-back Millie Bright has been out with a knee injury since March. She's made the squad, and Serena Wiegmann says that Bright will captain the team in the absence of the injured defender Leah Williamson. The midfielder Frank Kirby already ruled out through injury, but the Barcelona defender Lucy Bronze is in despite having knee surgery in April. Really what I'm getting from that, Molly, is it's a squad that we could possibly be excited about in some areas, but also clearly some worries over where the team will be physically.
Yeah, completely. I think it's slightly strange build up, really, because I think having come off the back of the Euros win last summer, I think England were definitely one of the favourites for the World Cup, and you know, I think they still can be. I think they still are, but I think we have to be realistic, particularly with England's defence. I mean, if we go back to kind of the Phil Neville era, it was always a weak area for England, and it felt as though Wiegmann came in and really sorted it out. She found this partnership with Leah Williamson and Millie Bright, and it just worked almost perfectly. Now, obviously, that's been broken up with Williamson's injury, and then you end up with a weakness at centre-back, obviously Millie Bright, who has been named as captain, but Wiegmann hasn't even told her that she's captain because she's been focusing on her rehab, and she really does have a bit of a race against time to be fit for that first game. She's not back in team training yet. Hopefully she will be by that game on the 22nd of July. But either way, she won't be, you know, fully match fit. She won't have had a lot of minutes behind her. Then you have left back, which is a real problem area for England, because your left back of the Euros is England's scorer this season, is absolutely flying as a striker. So I think what England have is a very, very, very exciting front line. I was really happy for Beth England, who made the move from Chelsea to Tottenham, who were battling relegation the whole season. She's pretty much single-handedly kept them up. Everyone I speak to is saying what a fantastic character she is to have in the dressing room. She's really knuckled down, worked hard, and she just looked as though she wasn't a Wiegmann kind of player. Wiegmann just wasn't really interested in the last camp when we all thought she would go. So I think credit to Wiegmann. She's basically said to us yesterday that she couldn't not pick her. Beth England has been so good for Tottenham. And I think what England have to try and do is maximise their attacking talent. Obviously, we haven't even mentioned Alessia Russo, who was so fantastic in the Euros and has been doing well for Manchester United this season. So there you've got three out-and-out strikers who are all in fantastic form. And we don't even have one left-back that's kind of in form or a proper left-back. All of the options are pretty much makeshift players that can play sort of across the back line. So I think Wiegmann's really going to have a task on her hands to try and extract the most she possibly can out of the players that are in form and doing well, and just kind of keep the attention away from that left back slash the defence generally.
It's going to be an intriguing one for England this World Cup. I think some of the injuries, maybe some feel that kind of takes England's chance away of really winning this tournament. You think of the creative and goal-scoring abilities of Mead and Kirby, the leadership of Williamson as well. Do you believe that once you've seen this squad, you sit back and say, okay, we've got a chance, or is it one of those where it's almost a hit and hope?
I think England have a chance, and I think part of that comes down to some of the issues that are almost having the other nations. I think what we all know is men's or women's football, to win a tournament, you need everything to go pretty much perfect for you. And that's exactly what happened in the Euros last summer. They got through the entire tournament without really an injury of note. Wiegmann was allowed to play the same 11 players that started every match. It kind of went very straightforward. I think that won't be the case this summer. But I think you look at America, who are obviously the reigning champions, probably the favourites just because it's America and it's a World Cup and they always win. But it hasn't been really straightforward for them under Vlatko Andonowski, their manager. I think there's a feeling that that's a squad in transition that maybe isn't as strong as perhaps US teams have been in the past. We know Spain, who have absolutely ridiculous, quite frankly, talent, but several of them may not play in the tournament because there's this ongoing falling out with Jorge Vilda, their manager, and the Spanish Federation. France are something of an unknown under Herve Renard. Again, very new, kind of coming into an environment that's been a bit of a mess with the French Federation. So I think we might be looking here at a scenario of Germany, who we could meet in the quarterfinal, perhaps being the most settled and well-rounded team in this tournament. So I think England need to really build into it. They've got a really favourable group, Haiti, China and Denmark. You know, England should be flying through that really if they have any hope of winning this thing. And then it gets very difficult very quickly. You're looking at a round of 16 game, either against Canada, who won the gold in Tokyo 2020, or you're looking at Australia, the hosts, who, quite frankly, you want to avoid as much as you possibly can, with Sam Kerr leading the line. So I think that becomes difficult. And then you're looking at a quarterfinal with Germany. So it could be a very difficult route for England. And I suppose that does mirror a little bit of what we saw last summer, because we all looked at that quarterfinal with Spain as one where easily England could have lost. Obviously, it ended up going to extra time and they won it. And then after that, it was like, well, they're probably going to win now. And I think it'll be very much the same situation where that Germany quarterfinal, if that is the way that it does end up playing out, could well be almost the final when you look at the strengths and weaknesses of the other teams in the competition. But I have to say, I do worry for our defence.
Finally, it's just one more point about the Women's World Cup that I do need to raise. At this point in time, the five biggest European nations haven't yet signed a TV deal, including us, to broadcast it this summer. And it's hurtling towards us. I mean, we are not far away from this World Cup at all. I think under 50 days now. What is going on and how big a concern is this going to be?
To be frank, there's a lot of issues that are a mess right now in women's football relating to this Women's World Cup. We have the ongoing scheduling issue where clubs are not willing to release players until the 23rd of June and England want to start their camp on the 19th of June. So as of yet, we have no start date for the camp because the negotiations are continuing. Whether they can start on the 19th or the 23rd affects whether England will be even able to have a send-off game. That's up in the air. We have no broadcast deal. We have no idea as to whether the One Love armbands are going to be able to be worn. England have been in talks with FIFA for literally months since before Christmas. This has been going on. A decision still hasn't been made. And I certainly got the sense of frustration from Serena Wiegmann yesterday at the squad announcement. There's just so much up in the air, and kind of the FA's best laid plans, I suppose, are just completely wrecked, really. I think of those three issues, I think the TV deal actually is possibly the easiest to solve. We understand that BBC and ITV are in discussions to try and split the fixtures. And I think of those European nations you mentioned, I think England are in a slightly better place than the others. So I think the broadcasters are fairly optimistic that they will get something sorted. But obviously, it's not ideal. Obviously, FIFA are playing hardball with this. They want to get as much money as they possibly can, despite perhaps not recognising that this is a tournament in Australia. It's not going to be prime broadcast times when these games are going to be, like, early in the morning. I think it's sort of 9 or 10 a.m. over here is when they're going to kick off. So there's, to be honest, Hugh, there's a lot of things that are a mess at the moment. And as you say, I think today is 49 days out. And I think certainly Serena Wiegmann is just hoping that all of these people can get in a room, make these decisions, because it's just really affecting preparation at this point.
Okay, Molly Hudson, thank you for being with me on the Game Podcast. Thanks to Gregor Robertson and Tom Ruddy once again, and to all of you for listening. Big FA Cup final ahead of us this weekend. We're going to have all the reaction on Monday to that. All of the big stories, as well as we build up to West Ham and Europa Conference League final and Manchester City in a Champions League final too. So make sure you're with us on Monday. You won't miss an episode. Just hit the bell, the notification button there, or make sure you're subscribed. You can go to thetimes.co.uk. / the game. And if you want to read that, it's in the paper each and every Monday. We'll see you then. Take care.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.